morning. I'm Michael Cathcart, and you're very, very welcome to Books and Arts here on RN. Today we look at some people who were unwilling subjects of portraits. Yes, the arts journalist Fiona Gruber is back with more in her series on portraits, and British-Canadian author Tom Rackman. His second novel, The Rise and Fall of Great Powers, offers some lessons about understanding your own life. But let's start with this. Andy Warhol looks a scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell him apart at all. David Bowie with Andy Warhol from his 1971 classic Hunky Dory. Well, the visual arts critic and historian Hal Foster has been a dynamic thinker in the visual arts since he put together a collection called Anti-Aesthetic, Essays on Postmodern Culture, more than three decades ago. And I remember it very well because all of us who are interested in art and cultural theory went out and bought it. This Saturday, Hal is giving a lecture called On the Rapport Between Photography and Painting in Pop Art at the Art Gallery of New South Wales, which is, of course, why we played Andy Warhol, because he'd have to be in there somewhere, wouldn't he? And this is in association with this big exhibition that's on at the Art Gallery at the moment called Pop to Popism. And we're joined now from Sydney by Hal Foster. Welcome to the show, Hal.
Thanks, Michael.
When did art first start to speak to you? Were you just a little boy who suddenly had a moment when it all lit up for you?
Well, I think we all have origin stories. I mean, my primal scene happened in Seattle. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest. I was about 12, and I happened to go into the living room of my best friend, and I saw a thing on the wall. I knew it was a painting, but that's about it. It was abstract, I knew later. It was a series of just rectangles of color, and it was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. And I thought, after I had this aesthetic experience, why do they have it and we do not? So at that moment, this is the story that I tell at least, I knew that I was devoted to art, but I also thought that I should be a critic rather than an artist because I had this feeling of social tension with the whole world of art too, as much as I loved it. And the painting happened to be a Mark Rothko, so it remains the most beautiful thing I've ever seen.
Is it also a story of envy?
Totally. I think to have a little bit of resentment is necessary to be a good critic. You have to have an edge.
So there you are, your edgy self thinking, why haven't we got a Rothko at our house?
It sounds pathetic now.
Oh, it sounds discriminating. That's what it sounds.
Well, I don't want to project a personality that just sees with jealousy, but well, there you have it.
I guess. I am. No, I'm not trying to make you sound like a grabby little boy, but that's a powerful, powerful story. So I know that minimalism has spoken to you profoundly, but also pop art. What draws you to pop art particularly, or what did draw you to pop art back in the day?
Well, I suppose it was the sense that this art showed us how we are images too as people. I think it develops a whole new idea of what it is to be a person. A person as image, perhaps an image with some of the qualities of personhood. I mean, you began with that fabulous song of Bowie on Warhol, this idea that he is a silver screen. I mean, on the one hand, absolutely iconic. On the other hand, very spectral. I mean, the epitaph he wanted was figment. And I think pop captured this new sense of what it was to be a subject, to have subjectivity, both bound up with the image in the full sense of that one could be, you know, a celebrity, but also one could be, you know, almost a shadow. And Warhol, from an early age, really beguiled me precisely because he was both at once. I mean, as a young person in New York, I would see him on the streets and he was so there and so not there in the same instant.
For me, the dilemma in understanding pop art, as someone who didn't see Andy Warhol walking around in my hood.
Well, it's not like we were best friends. I wasn't, you know, a hanger-on at the factory, though I wish I were.
Yeah, I could just see him saying, "Nick off, kid."
Totally.
One of the dilemmas for me is I can never quite figure whether pop art is some kind of critique of consumer society, some kind of subversive intervention, or whether it's an example of how art is turning itself into the ultimate commodity, you know, so that the label of the soup can is worth more than the soup inside it.
Right. Michael, I think that's it exactly. You have to think both those things at the same time with the very best pop art. Richard Hamilton, a terrific British artist who is absolutely crucial to the development of the idea of pop art, he borrowed this phrase from Duchamp, from Marcel Duchamp. This phrase is the ironism of affirmation. So it seems to be affirmative. It seems to be positive about the new world of consumer capitalism. But there's always an ironic twist. There's always a turn somewhere, again, in the best work, I think, of pop. And again, with Warhol, it's even stronger. You know, his signature series, he wanted to call Death and Disaster. I mean, these are the car crashes, the electric chairs, even some of the Marilyns and Liz's and Elvis's. He showed a real dark side to popular culture, to mass media. And I think there is a real critique there. But it's both those things at once. It's critical and it's complicit. And the problem when pop turns into popism is that I think it loses that bite.
Now, you're a critic, and you've always been prepared to celebrate some artists and to question the value of others. And, of course, you're not alone in this. I mean, critics in the media do this. Jed Pearl does it. Peter Sheldahl does it. The late Robert Hughes did it. They're robust critics. But you're also based, well, these days anyway, in the university sector, in academia, where you're a senior professor. And it does seem to me that academics, interestingly, have lost belief in the validity of the critical project. In fact, while I was an academic, I sort of saw this happen. You know, I went in the 70s into an English department, which was full of critics who were quite happy to tell you what was a great novel and what wasn't. And by the end of my time at university, there was real anxiety about making any kind of quality call at all. But you've maintained your confidence in your capacity to do this. Can you talk to that?
That's a terrific question. I mean, like you, I entered the university, actually in the 1980s. I did work as an independent scholar, as we used to say. I mean, I think that's almost a vanished species for a time. But when I came back to the university, it was at a moment when critical theory was all the rage. So that's really how I snuck into the university. I don't think I would have made it in the present. But I do think that it's important as a critic to hold on to judgment. There were many, many critiques of critique, if you like. People became suspicious of the very idea of judgment. I mean, under what authority do you make a claim about value? There was the whole problem of value. When you make a judgment, do you add value, commercial value, to works of art? I mean, there were all kinds of concerns about critical judgment. And, you know, I think many are valid. I mean, who is the voice? What is the voice that praises or condemns? But without judgment, there's no criticism. At the end of the day, or even at the beginning, I think you have to lay down your cards and tell others what matters to you and why.
Well, that period when you enter the universities is the high noon of postmodernism. And I suppose at its best, postmodernism was saying we must mistrust the notion of a master narrative, because usually it's, you know, white men who are sort of calling the shots for everybody else. We have to allow that there are many realities, many cultures all in play, and we have to be alert to those. That seems to me to be a great opening of the mind of Western universities. But at its most banal, postmodernism was taken to mean anything goes. We can no longer make any kind of discriminations about anything, because the text on the back of a cornflakes packet is as valid as King Lear, or the picture on the front of a cornflakes packet is as valid as a Rothko.
Right, and that's precisely the problem. I think postmodernism did degenerate quite quickly into a banal form of cultural studies in which claims of relative worth were thrown out of court, in effect. But when I began to use this term with my colleagues at October Magazine and other publications, we meant a very precise practice by the idea of postmodernism. It was a real critique of modernist ideas of the work of art, the work of literature, the work of music. So, and precisely around questions of who has the right to be an author, who has the right to be an artist. And it was really driven, at least in my milieu, which was essentially the pictures generation of artists like Cindy Sherman and Sherry Levine and Barbara Kruger. It was really driven by feminism and then subsequently queer theory, post-colonial discourse. I mean, and you're absolutely right. The real question there was master narratives. I mean, they were under attack. But that I really want to hold on to that initial critical impulse. Soon enough, postmodernism was captured as a banal idea of the culture at large. And you know, that still actually disturbs me. I don't use the term much anymore because I think it's emptied out.
Well, as you point out, feminism, queer theory, and post-colonial studies were three little capsules of critical perspective that maintained their integrity in this great storm of postmodernism. You could go in there and you could be a feminist and critique texts because you could see them as examples of expressions of patriarchy and queer theory. Obvious what you're saying there. In post-colonial studies, again, you could critique the master narrative for it, the power relations it was setting up with your own reality if you were Indian, say, from the continent of India. And so on. So, yeah, there were ways in which you could keep a conversation about quality going. Do you think we've returned, or do you think we've come through that that disquiet about whether we can make calls of judgment now, whether we can tell quality of work from the rest of the pack?
I'm not sure we have. I mean, I don't want to suggest that all those critiques were simply assimilated and emptied out. I think they did make for real structural change in departments and programs. I think institutions did shift, and I think that's really important to underscore. But I'm not sure that we've come back to a moment when critical judgment is accepted, really. There's a term now, it's a term that I develop in a book that will appear in the fall. The term is post-critical, and I think that many people are involved in cultural practice are happy to leave critique behind. I'm just not one of them.
Yeah, so is post-critical a pejorative term, is it?
No, I think for many people it's an affirmative term.
But I mean in the way you use it in your book.
Oh, yeah, it always ends with a question mark for me.
Hmm. Now, I know another issue that you've been writing about recently is the design and functions of museums. And as you point out, in the 19th century, museums displayed artworks that might also have been displayed in houses. But today there is a species of art that is created as gallery art. There are these top-end artists who know if they make something enormous and spectacular, a gallery will buy it, which has changed the game somewhat.
Totally. Right now, I think museums confront not just huge political questions, economic questions, but they also confront architectural questions. And the way I see it is essentially this. There's a certain model of exhibition, or there was, for modern art, and we came to call it the white cube. It was an abstract space that suited abstract work. But as artists, after the war, especially after World War II, began to test the limits of the white cube, galleries just had to expand. I mean, this was the time of the idea of an expanded field of sculpture, an expanded field of art in general. And as a result, museums had to get bigger. In part, they did so through the refashioning of old industrial structures. I mean, as we moved into a post-industrial economy, this is one thing one could do with old turbine halls, for example, as in the Tate. But it led to a whole new paradigm, which is this gigantic space, this huge gallery driven by artists like Richard Serra, who demanded that kind of space. So bigness became a real problem in the museum. So right away, you have, in any modern and contemporary art museum, you have to have the white cube, you have to have huge galleries. More and more, you also have to have a black box, a space for art that projects images that might not be film, but might use film and video. There's also a return to performance and dance in the museum of visual art as well. So you need spaces for performative work. I mean, sometimes they're called gray boxes, as some, you know, hybrid of the white cube and the black box. So you have all these different spatial models that any museum that purports to show an expansive range of work from the modern to the contemporary must somehow have. And it's very difficult to do architecturally. It's also very difficult to program. And I think that's a real dilemma for museums right now.
It's also a dilemma as we wind up for architects, because on the one hand, there is this impulse by the leading architects to create these massively, well, egocentric, I guess, buildings that are so distinctive and strange and wild. On the other hand, they have to create these big sort of vaults inside that are sort of neutral and impersonal, so that the work of art exists in this kind of pristine void.
Absolutely. I mean, you can think about it in a way as a space war between architects like Frank Gehry and artists like Richard Serra.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
It's, you know, it is a problem. And it also can lead to terrific work, both architecturally and artistically. But there's another problem here, too, which is the need for the museum as icon. I mean, this is now a familiar problem that one can associate with Gehry still. I mean, I think the Guggenheim Bilbao remains the best example. You know, a city, a region, even a country that wants to retool for a new economy of culture, of entertainment, you know, takes up the museum as a way to do so. It's not only a physical space that attracts visitors, attracts tourists, it also can become an emblem, an icon for that city, that region, that country. So there's a very strong economic logic to this development of museums, and it's not simply museums. I mean, we see this this use of architecture everywhere now.
We do. Hal, it's been lovely to meet you. Thank you for coming by.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you.
Hal Foster. And Hal is Professor of Art and Archaeology at Princeton University. He's in Sydney in partnership with the Power Institute at the University of Sydney and in association with the Pop to Popism exhibition, which is now on at the Art Gallery of New South Wales, which is in its very last day. So you'll have to hurry along if you're in Sydney to see that one. I hear it's very, very good. And his book is called The First Pop Age: Painting and Subjectivity, and it's published by Princeton University Press. On RN, this is Books and Arts. I'm Michael Cathcart. I've come to like that song. Didn't like it when I first heard it, although I always have loved the video clip. You know, that's the one where he's singing and all this painting appears over him and the girl he used to know, it sort of vanishes from. Except it should be someone who I used to know, I always think, not or whom, I suppose. Anyway, it was a number one pick in Triple J's Hottest 100 in 2011. And as it turns out, 2011 is the starting point in British-Canadian author Tom Rackman's second novel, which is called The Rise and Fall of Great Powers. Now, this book spans three decades, and I'm joined now by producer Sarah Lestrange. Sarah, Matilda Zilberg, I guess it is the main character. Who's she?
Well, yes, it's hard to pronounce, isn't it? She's had a very unusual upbringing. She moved every year with her father until she was about 10, and then she moved around the world with three very eccentric people, not going to school but learning life's lessons from the people around her. And when we meet her in the novel, this is in 2011, she owns a failing secondhand bookshop in Wales, but there are questions about her past that tug at her, and she sets out to answer those questions.
Yes, and there are quite a few interesting characters she meets there, including a chap in the bookshop. Well, Tom Rakeman joins us now from our Brisbane studios, and he's talking to Sarah.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Tom, I want to share with you something I remembered recently, and I wonder whether you remember when we first met, I interviewed you about your debut novel, The Imperfectionists, and afterwards you accidentally dropped your mobile phone over the level 4 balcony, and we then spent a good amount of time looking for the remains of your phone. I think you wanted to get the SIM card.
Yeah, I'd completely forgotten, but now I remember it vividly. That's really funny, yeah.
And I raise this because the main character in your novel, Matilda, or Tuli, she just wouldn't understand what the fuss is about losing a mobile phone because she's not of the digital world, although she is in the digital age.
Yeah, that's true. I think that one of the features of the main character of this book is that she's caught between all sorts of different things, between wanting to have her own life detached from the way that society is and at other points feeling the incursions of that society upon her. And in the present day, the biggest incursions are the digital ones. So when we first meet her, she's running this dusty little, hopeless, frankly, bookshop. And happy
I think that's
to
how
be...
most bookshop owners feel
come
these
on.
Days.
No, don't say that. But she's happy to be surrounded by all of these printed friends of hers with no batteries and the sorts of things you can drop off a balcony and then go and pick up and collect without having to worry about the SIM card. And she finds herself, however, increasingly affected, as we all are, by the digital world as it sort of surrounds us and closes in useful and sometimes even in confusing and threatening ways. And in fact, her story is one that funnily is sort of set off by the internet age that she has avoided, because though she's happy holed up in that shop reading her books and dealing with her rather useless assistant
Fog
and all of that Fog.
What a great name for an assistant at a secondhand bookshop.
Well, she's happy to just to hang around there. But then a message reaches her on, of all places, on Facebook, and she finds herself drawn back into this one story that she, this lifelong great reader, has never really understood, which is the story of her own life.
And then we track her life over three decades. In fact, I think she's my age, because her story flits between 1988, when she's 9 or 10, then 1999, and then the present 2011. Why these times did you want to focus on Tuli's life?
Well, to explain, the book is divided into these three different sections, those periods that you mentioned, and they're interspersed throughout the book. So what I wanted was an effect of jumping among these three different periods, both in her life and also in the times that we're living in. I was interested in writing a book that was primarily, I hope, a good story with great characters, but I was also curious to try to engage in some way with the world that we're living in right now, which seems to me to be an amazingly fascinating place, not just for all these digital things that I was talking about, but also the politics of it. And to tell the story of the present day, it seemed to me necessary to go back 25 years. And the start of that story is in 1988, so just before the end of the Cold War, the fall of the Soviet Union, and the reordering of the world. And then the next section chronologically is 1999, so just before the changes of the millennium and the attacks of September 11th and all of the disasters and problems that followed that, up to more or less the present day, with the implication that once again, perhaps we are poised just on the cusp of some extraordinarily significant change. And I don't entirely define what that might be, but I pose a few possibilities.
Well, the times are always changing, I guess. And I guess these times that you've touched on and the different historical changes that occur at those times. These are the rise and fall of great powers. But I wonder, is there also a more personal rise and fall of great powers in the life of Thule?
Yeah, definitely there is. The title, I hope that the title would, for somebody who reads the book, resonate in a sort of puzzling and hopefully interesting way, that it's a novel, and the title sounds like a little bit like nonfiction, a lot like nonfiction. But as you read it, I hope that the reader will think to themselves, what exactly are these powers rising and falling? There's, of course, the political powers, the empires, like the empire of the United States that sort of rose to perhaps its peak around the time of the millennium and faced all sorts of threats and decline after that. But there are other senses, as you implied there, and one of the key ones is the rise and fall of great powers in the sense of influences of other people over the course of your life, so that there might be one person who, let's say an aunt who seems like this great hero of yours in childhood, who in a later stage of life seems an altogether different sort of person, or just in reverse, say a younger brother who seems a fool as a kid and then later on has a depth of character that you don't realize. So that sort of rise and fall of influences was one of the more personal aspects of it. But also, I was interested in fleshing out or discussing the rise and fall of great powers over the course of a single lifespan. So the rise in competency and knowledge in childhood up to adulthood, where you find the limits of your great powers, and then till old age, where you start to see those powers dissolve and dissipate before your eyes. And there are different characters in this book who are facing precisely those key moments of life.
For a significant part of this book, there's a lot of guessing games that the reader has to go through. The reader guesses at Thule's relationship with people. For instance, in the 1988 section, when she's just a girl, Thule travels with Paul to Bangkok. We don't know if Paul is her father. He won't even hug her. Why the mystery? This isn't a mystery book.
It's not a mystery book in the sense of daggers and disguises, definitely not. But it is a mystery in a way, I suppose. There's actually a point where the character you mentioned, Fogg, her assistant in the bookshop, says when she's trying to figure out what's going on or what has gone on in her life, and she's starting to falter in her pursuit of that information, he says, don't stop yet. This is starting to become a mystery story. And the mystery here is almost like not a whodunit, but a who is she? And in a way, she's just trying to work out the details of what happened and looking back to her past because it was such a confused one. And I intend it primarily as her story, hopefully an interesting one, one that for reasons that come clear was confusing and misled at the time. But I think that there are elements that might resonate with the way that one does look back at one's past and tries to figure out quite how one became who one is. And there's always that question, is one created by one's influences, by one's past, by one's family and friends and location and identity and sense of belonging? Or is one created by a sort of essence, a particular you that would have been the same whether you'd been born in a different country or in a different century? And whether you have any agency over that or whether you're purely defined outwardly. And I think that those are the sorts of mysteries and questions that are alluded to in her own search.
But I really was worried at one point that she'd been abducted, because there's this mystery about what happens to her after she's 10 and goes on to live with these three other people who aren't Paul, who aren't her father. You know, I was really worried for her. But once again, it set me up to think one thing when actually the story was going in another way. Was that intentional to create that worry?
Probably, yeah. I apologize that I caused you such distress. No, definitely.
Thank you for your apology.
I think it's definitely one of those things. I think it's part of the drama of storytelling that you try to orchestrate everything in a way that you very carefully feed out the bits of information as they seem fit, as they seem necessary, and as they seem intriguing. And also there's this I think what's key in this book is what I alluded to before, the way that these different time periods are mixed up. Then it means that the story isn't told from day one to day 100, let's say. It's told in a big mixed hodgepodge. And as a result of that, it's almost inevitable if you were to see glimpses of anybody's life at different stages, there would be things that would be unclear, but gradually they would come together. And I suppose that I imagined the structure or the effect of this book is something akin to standing very, very close to a very, very large painting at the start and looking at a few details of that and recognizing what those represented, but being unable to make sense of the entirety of the picture, and gradually with each chapter taking one step back so that by the end of the book you finally see the entirety of what was intended and the entirety of her story. But it's inevitable in the way that the story is told that there are going to be bits that are out of focus early on and gradually will come into focus, and even parts that appear to come into focus and then once seen within the context of the whole picture change their shape entirely.
They certainly do, and you really do have to read the whole book to get the whole picture. Thanks so much for talking to me, Tom Rackman, today.
Thank you, Sarah, and thanks for helping me fix my phone.
You're welcome.
Sarah Lestrange there. So his phone did come good, did it?
Well, I think we found the phone.
That's all I care about.
We found the phone. He was able to get the SIM card. No, the phone was pretty destroyed, but the SIM card is a crucial thing.
Oh, yeah, I see. So he went. The SIM card went on to have another life.
Yeah.
Thank goodness for that. The book is called The Rise and Fall of Great Powers. It's published, Sarah, by
Text.
This is Books and Arts on RN. I'm Michael Cathcart. Next up, portraits and the case of the unwilling sitter.
Our feature album on ABC Jazz this week is from the pioneering pianist Chick Corea, who just picked up 2 Grammy Awards for his new album, Trilogy. ABC Jazz. Listen on your TV, your digital radio, online with the ABC Radio Player, or on your mobile via the ABC Radio app.
Yes, there are so many ways to listen to us here on RN. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm one of those people who's not very comfortable about having his photograph taken. I sort of like to step to one side and get out of the picture. In episode 4 of our Australian Portrait series, radio producer and arts journalist Fiona Gruber and her co-host, Angus Trumbull, who is the director of the National Portrait Gallery in Canberra, take a look at a few unwilling subjects with artist Vernon R. Key.
My island home is waiting for me.
Hello and welcome to another exploration of portraits. Today we look at how works dehumanise in pictures of Aboriginals and of convicts. There are 2 stories that illustrate both: the photo of Fenian convict James Wilson and the drawings of Vernon R. Key. In the 1930s and 50s, Australian ethnologist Norman Tyndale visited Aboriginal missions throughout Australia, taking photographs of their inhabitants. Some of them were the ancestors of Vernon R. Key, an Indigenous Queensland-based artist whose work was part of the 2009 Venice Biennale. He's used Tyndale's images as the basis for a series of powerful, detailed drawings of his family, usually on a very big scale. Vernon, tell us about your work.
The whole idea of the portraiture project is that I want to produce an idea of the Aborigine in Australia that is complex and laden with emotion and depth and intelligence and sophistry, but stripped away of all those narrow ideas that are really old and not of much use to us.
Tell us a bit about the reasons that you have created these works based on photographs of your grandparents and other family members taken sort of like as ethnographic exhibits.
Yeah, I was a bit kind of put out by the context that those archival images are presented in. They're presented as a scientific record. And when you try to find your family, they ask you for the code. So it's a number, not a name. And I understand that the way the archive is put together, the Tyndale archive I'm talking about, it's cataloguing people along with objects and everything else that Tyndale was looking at.
So he was travelling around Australia photographing people, Indigenous people, but with a sort of a view that he was photographing a dying race.
Yeah, so he was sent out to, one, to document the dying race, but also his expedition over 30 years was also sponsored by Harvard in the US, because his speciality was genealogies, and if you read a lot of his research, you can see he's very comprehensive in how he goes about recording genealogies and lots of interviews and his notebooks and everything. You know, this is during the era of some quite disturbing race theory about blood quantums and the chain of being and that. And Harvard actually sponsored his expedition because they wanted to solve the black problem, their own black problem in America. And he was ostensibly sent out to kind of research how breeding out the black skin could be achieved in America. And so that's how disturbing it gets.
Well, it is a sort of form of, you know, planned genocide in a way. A look at a people that just dehumanizes them completely. I mean, I did see an interview that you made where you said that if you could ask Norman Tyndale a question, you would say, did you regard my ancestors as human?
Yeah. I'm pretty sure he didn't. So, you know, he saw them as scientific subjects to be noted, that's all. I mean, you're talking about someone who lands in a missions. He went around to all the missions and reserves in Queensland. And I'm talking about the Queensland experience anyway. He also was in South Australia and Victoria, New South Wales. And he would land there, and this is during an era when the missions were very much under control of state government and police, particularly in Queensland, and Palm Island in particular, where my grandmother's family was sent and my mother was born, was particularly brutal for decades. And so he lands there as this white man and very much at the behest of local government and local authority, and always with police escort and authority behind him. And so these people had no choice but to sit and be interviewed by him. It's doubtful any of them wished it.
No, well, they don't look very happy in it. So he and his wife, your great-grandfather, were both photographed by Tyndale, is that right?
Yeah.
In your triptych, Neither Pride Nor Courage, that fantastic triptych you did of your great-grandfather and your son, and he looks quite angry, but he's not cowed in any way. Your great-grandfather's a handsome man, but he is obviously doing what he's told because he has no choice. But your son looks very kind of combative.
Yeah. And for me, what struck me from the very first image is this gaze. And for me, it was a gaze of persistence and endurance and intelligence and emotion and resistance. And I wanted to achieve that. I wanted to produce an idea of the Aborigine that was stripped of all the romantic ideas around the noble savage, and also the ideas around the idea that we should be sorry for ourselves, which is a big trade now. But that persistence in the gaze and the fire and the idea that we are still here is in my sons. And my daughter, and my cousins, and my nephews and nieces, and I wanted to show that you can draw a line from three or four generations back, and there is that sense of identity and persistence that is still there, and endurance.
And you chose
that's the idea.
They're charcoal drawings. There's an honesty in drawing a line, isn't there, as well, and a kind of an unflinchingness. I remember reading something you said that's unlike paint, where you can change things and paint over. There's an honesty to a line.
I talk often about the idea that there's no hiding in drawing. There's one line next to the other and nothing in between, nothing underneath and nothing on top. So you have to show yourself. I think drawing's kind of coming back now because people are kind of appreciating what the quality of good drawing says about who they are as an artist or people. And there's a reason why a lot of people don't draw is that you show too much of yourself. It's like handwriting. And I think a lot of people won't draw because you have to show yourself. You have to show who you are.
You're listening to Books and Arts Daily, and I'm talking portraits with artist Vernon Arkie. Angus Trumbull from the National Portrait Gallery in Canberra is with us. Angus.
Are you ever tempted to bring the strength of your gaze to non-Aboriginal subjects?
Well, not for the time being. That's something I don't rule out. But right now I mostly focus on my own family, and I've got a big family.
The reason I ask is that the confronting quality of the work is so moving. It strikes me that it would be fascinating to, in a sense, reverse the gaze back onto subjects who themselves looked at Aboriginal people in the way that you described of Tyndall.
Oh, yeah, but there's enough portraits of yes. people who aren't Aboriginal. So I'm not trying to produce portraiture that is overly sympathetic or romantic in any way. So I'm trying to produce portraits that show a contemporary people with the complexity and sophistry that everybody else is allowed to show in their portraiture, but for some reason blackfellas don't. And I still see Aboriginal subjects produced as portraiture who still are kind of framed in this very narrow way, and it's so disappointing to me because we live contemporary lives, and when we engage with each other as Aboriginal peoples, we see each other as peoples, fully realised peoples, and then we have to be confronted by these portrayals of us where we are portrayed in very narrow terms, and it's so disappointing. Yeah, that's the idea, is I'm rehumanising, I guess, that's all.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks for coming on, Vernon, and good luck with the next project.
Yeah, thank you.
She was a Yankee whale ship called the Catalpa by name. Came out to Western Australia, stole six of our convicts away.
Now, we've talked to Vernon Arkie about the way his ancestors were dehumanised through portraiture, photographs, and, you know, creating a gallery of types rather than individuals. That was the same case with photographs of convicts, and some of them we know more about than others. And I'm really interested to hear your tale of James Wilson or Seamus MacLearmore, who was a political convict, wasn't he?
Indeed he was. And, of course, the first point is that we lack photographic mugshots, if you like, or portraits by the authorities of convicts, people sentenced to transportation, precisely because the system was winding down even at the time of the invention of photography, or at least of its earliest development. And in this case, James Wilson, who was a Fenian, an Irishman, who deserted from the British Army.
And Fenians were people...
Irish Republicans.
They wanted to get rid of the British.
That's right. They were the, I guess, the forerunners of the Irish Republican Army. Fenian plots to assassinate various British statesmen and members of the royal family, including the Queen. A few of them succeeded, the assassination of the Duke of Devonshire, the Lord Lieutenant of Ireland. But in this instance, James Wilson was tried for desertion, and he deserted the British Army in order to become a member of the Fenian Association. And so he was, as you rightly say, essentially a political convict. And he was transported to Western Australia in 1867. Now, the point about Western Australia that's so interesting is that Western Australia decided to take on the system long after Van Diemen's Land, Tasmania, New South Wales and Queensland had abolished it or decided to abolish it. And this was the last gasp of the system. But he was sentenced to hard labour, and his experience in Western Australia was so grievous that he wrote in some desperation to an American newspaper editor who was so moved by the plight of Wilson and other Fenians in Western Australia that a converted whaler called the Catalpa was dispatched to rescue them in 1876, and the rescue was successful. And in later life, incredibly, Wilson settled in, of all places, Pawtucket, Rhode Island, a very beautiful community on Long Island Sound, within reach of the great centres of Irish-American patriotism in Boston and, of course, in New York City. And there, just before he died in 1921, he met Eamon de Valera. So in a way, Wilson joins the mid-19th century post-famine, if you like, efflorescence, the first inklings of an Irish independence movement, and almost the arrival of the Irish Free State in 1922. But his image, meanwhile, taken as a convict with his label hanging around his neck, is about as abject an image as you can possibly imagine. A look of desperate physical hardship, of resentment, a gaze that sends a shiver, I think, down any spine that comes into direct contact with it.
It sure does. And you can see that image on the website and you can see it under the portrait section. Thank you so much, Angus Trumbull. What a fascinating story.
Thank you, Fiona.
Come all ye screw warders and jailers, remember Perth Regatta Day. Take care of the rest of your Fenians, or the Yankees will steal them away.
Arts journalist Fiona Gruber and her co-host Angus Trumbull with episode 4 of their series on Australian portraits. Next week, episode 5, they'll be talking about sex, power and money in the world of portraiture. And for more information on that series and for the images we've been discussing, you just head along to our website, Books and Arts, and you'll find everything you need to know there. Now let's head to the movies.
How did we end up here? This place is horrible. Smells like balls. We had it all. You were a movie star, remember?
Who was this guy? Used to be Birdman.
I like that poster.
You wrote this adaptation?
I did, yeah.
And you're directing and starring in your adaptation. That's ambitious.
Are you afraid people will say you're doing this play to battle the impression that you're a washed-up comic strip character?
Absolutely not. That's why 20 years ago...
Some audio there from the trailer for the film Birdman, which was the big winner at the Oscars in L.A. yesterday. A good film, I reckon. It won the awards for Best Picture and Best Director. Let's see what RN's film critic Jason DeRosso has to say. Good morning.
Good morning.
Was this the right choice?
I think it was a predictable choice in many ways. Though, of course, people were picking Boyhood as well. Boyhood and Birdman seem to have been the two front runners for most of the awards. And yet Boyhood, and this is really the surprise of this Oscars, walked away with, you know, only one statue, and that was for Best Supporting Actress for Patricia Arquette. Birdman, however, you know, was predicted to certainly get a decent share of awards. People, I guess, were thinking that the Academy would split between Best Picture and Best Director and kind of share the love between Birdman and Boyhood, but it wasn't to be.
Am I detecting regret in your voice?
A little bit. I would have preferred Boyhood to perhaps get, well, to get up there for Best Picture, because it would have meant that, you know, we would have seen some recognition of Richard Linklater's quite outstanding achievement, I think, making this film over 12 years, shooting it for a couple of weeks a year for 12 years, and coming up with a film in which we see actors age before us, before our eyes on the big screen, within, you know, a 2.5 hour period. But Birdman is, I think, a predictable choice in that it's this film about movies. It's in some ways... Obviously, it's quite remarkable as a feat of movie making. You know, it won the Best Cinematography Award. It's a film that doesn't seem to have cuts, though time sort of fast forwards and slows down and does all sorts of weird things. But it's essentially a bit like Hitchcock's Rope. It looks like one long shot. So it's quite a feat. There's a great performance from Michael Keaton in the lead role, for which he didn't win an Oscar. I was surprised by that.
I thought he was going to, you know, because performers who play sort of people who are on the edge of madness often do quite well.
I thought he was pretty good in it, don't you? And I think that, he was my pick to win the Best Actor, in fact. And so I think it was a little bit of a pity he didn't. He was also my sort of sentimental favourite. But it's interesting, Birdman is the second lowest grossing Best Picture winner in the past 40 years. And it's really been an Oscars this year that was all about smaller films and independents. American Sniper was the big box office winner out of these films this year, out of the sort of main contenders this year. But it didn't walk away with, well, it hardly walked away with anything this year. And so it was a it was an Oscars that was marked by a bunch of films that most people, well, a lot of people hadn't really seen, and only a sort of small amount or relatively small amount of the film-going audience had bothered to turn up to pay and see, which is quite interesting, I think.
Jason, let's talk about the award-winning ceremony itself. There were lots of very strong speeches about all kinds of things. Here's a taste.
Call your mom, call your dad. If you're lucky enough to have a parent or two alive on this planet, call them. Don't text, don't email. Call them on the phone. Tell them you love them and thank them and listen to them for as long as they want to talk to you. Thank you.
It's our time to have wage equality once and for all and equal rights for women in the United States of America.
The subject of Citizen 4, Edward Snowden, could not be here tonight for some treason.
Right? Nina Simone said, it's an artist's duty to reflect the times in which we live. We wrote this song for a film that was based on events that were 50 years ago, but we say that Selma is now because the struggle for justice is right now.
Wow, it's very 1968. did the tone surprise you?
The tone, you know, in some ways didn't surprise me because I think that in the lead up to the Oscars, people were talking about how it was the whitest Oscars for a long time. It was the most male-skewed Oscars for a long time. So right from the very beginning, you saw them name-checking or indeed including on the stage in terms of people giving out awards and so forth, African-Americans. I mean, from the very beginning, you almost felt like, and in fact from, you know, Neil Patrick Harris's first gag about being a film full of the best and whitest. It was like this sort of Freudian slip, deliberate Freudian slip. The Oscars ceremony was all about referencing this perception that it was very white and very male. And then I think you get people like Patricia Arquette talking about how, you know, talking about, equal wage justice for women. And, of course, you have that great Best Original Song winner, the Glory from Selma, being a moment that sort of brought tears to people's eyes because Selma, of course, was a film that many perceived had been snubbed in terms of the amount of nominations it received. It only won that particular Oscar, and yet it was clearly one of the most, I mean, the performance of that song was clearly one of the most electrifying performances of the night because I think it was a moment representing a film that really touched a debate that's happening right now in America, and that's the post-Ferguson racial debate. And so in a way, the ceremony tried its best to kind of tap into the debates happening in the country at the moment where the nominations actually didn't, if you know what I mean. So, you know, in the absence of Selma actually being recognised through, you know, more nominations, I think you had this fantastic performance and this kind of great outpouring of emotion that sort of went some way, I suppose, to balancing the ledger. Because, as I say, it was in the approach to this year's Oscars, there was a lot of criticism about how it was so male skewed. It apparently is the most male and most and the whitest sort of Oscars in several years. So,
well, when I saw that Birdman had won all the awards, I thought, "Wow, it was a very blokey film." I mean, I went on my own.
It was a really blokey film. My problem with it, in a way, even though I mean the cinematography is wonderful and I think that main performance is wonderful, I found it rather self-indulgent, I have to say.
Yeah. I enjoyed it.
What did you think?
Well, I can't tell you because we've got to stop. Jason, thank you so much.
You're most welcome.
Jason DeRosso with his take on the 87th Annual Academy Awards in Los Angeles. And that concludes the program for today. Tomorrow, a very special program. We'll spend the whole hour in the company with Hilary Mantel. I recorded this at the Perth Festival over the weekend, and it's a wonderful conversation. I know you'll enjoy it. Don't forget, we're reading The God of Small Things. That's our book of the month coming up this coming Friday. And Earshot, that's coming up after the news. It's all about one of my favourite people in Australian history, the vagabond. Stay tuned for this. It's going to be marvellous. I'm Michael Cathcart, and this is RN. Bye-bye.